Welcome to Two Bards, One Mic. Insert interesting music here.
I swear we're actually going to get music one of these days.
Nah. 153. 153. That's right, you're only hearing one voice right now on the Two Bards, One Mic podcast because, well, yesterday was the Extra Life event that Andy was taking part in along with Matt Mansell and Brian Lewis from the Zoe DG side of things. And, well, he gamed for 24 hours straight, so he's taking the night off. However, what he was kind enough to do was record a interview with Todd Downing. He's got some exciting news to share about things coming up, I think, this week. Maybe even tomorrow or today, depending upon when you're listening to this. Or yesterday. Maybe you're catching up and it's 3 weeks ago. I don't know. But I'm sure all of that will be explained in the interview. I don't want to give away any spoilers, so I'm just going to let that speak to that. However, I do want to fill everyone in on the ongoing drama that is my PC. Now, despite the best efforts of Rob McLennan, who gave out some very well-wished thoughts and hopes and dreams and, well, you know, good tidings that I wouldn't have any more computer issues, I, after the last podcast, dove into the goodness that is my new processor that I just received and the new motherboard, and I ripped everything out again, I put everything back in, and when I tried to put in the memory, you guessed it, had to upgrade that too. So now, for three times the original cost, hopefully, according to Amazon, things will be shipped to me on Tuesday, and hopefully by the next podcast, I will have my new beast up and running with no more surprises. There shouldn't be any more surprises because I hooked everything up into this thing, minus the RAM. So I know everything fits. I know everything else should be good. So hopefully that's the way it sits. But not to be outdone by my counterpart, I too wanted to have a little interview at the beginning of this. And since it's really, really hard to get people from Seattle over here, I decided to bring what was already from Seattle here. So for one of the very few times, Jennifer Reifenberry will be joining me on this part of the podcast.
A few words here and there. That's about it.
Okay. Well, she has some insight into the fun and excitement that was this weekend. So I want her to impart some of that.
Right. The only holiday between Halloween and Christmas over here is Guy Fawkes Day.
Yes, or otherwise known as
Bonfire Day.
Bonfire Night.
Bonfire Night, which makes it more spectacular when you have a bonfire.
Yes. Yes, it's not as impressive during the daytime.
No, not.
It's not nearly as spooky.
Yeah.
Shadow-inducing.
Right.
As one might say.
And you know, it is pretty spooky because I think they tend to burn effigies in this bonfire.
Yes.
It's pretty weird.
And you did a little bit of research, which I kind of did, but just throw down the high points of what Guy Fawkes Day / Bonfire Night is all about.
Well, it's something about English history.
Isn't she good, folks? It's something about English history.
Yeah.
Fox is spelled F-A-W-K-E-S, not F-O-X. So totally English. Well, there you have it.
You want spellings? I will do spellings. I'm a spell freak. But there's something about he was guarding the gunpowder And they were planning to overthrow Parliament because they wanted King James
the first.
The first. In or out?
Out.
Out. Anyway, they caught him in this plot, and they punished him severely.
Right. In what year was this?
15-something.
Thought it was 1605.
Oh, okay.
Pretty sure that's the date you
gave
me.
Close enough.
Sure. So basically what happened was there was a plot to kill all of Parliament and King James I because they wanted to put a Church of England, a Catholic, right, because the Reformation hadn't happened yet. So they wanted to put a Catholic king back on the throne, which is funny because everybody uses Guy Fawkes or V for Vendetta to represent anarchy. And in fact, it was a movement of people trying to bring back government.
Right.
So
it's, right. And this guy also went by Guido Fawkes.
Wow,
because
really?
He fought for the Spanish. Because he was a fervent Catholic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, like Father Guido Sarducci.
Yeah, yeah.
For anyone who knows Saturday Night Live lore.
A long time ago.
Long time ago. So, we were going to go to, and I think that no one from the Hatton Pub is listening. so, I can freely say we were going to go to Hatton, which is just outside of Warrington, to the Hatton Pub for their big bonfire extravaganza. And, yeah, so you had to go there to get tickets, and I sent them an email 4 days in advance, and then I tried to call the night before, and then I called the day of and was told that they didn't have any more tickets.
Well, and it wouldn't be such a big deal, except we don't have a car.
Right, right. And I wasn't going to spend £10 to get over there to get tickets and all that rigmarole. Mm-hmm. So we put our thinking caps on while we were walking around on the day and decided to go into Liverpool for their River of Light, which was really awesome. You may have seen either of our Facebook pictures about that outside of the Liverpool Lime Street station. And they had an aerial show. They had pyrotechnic drum core and then a 20-minute relatively spectacular fireworks display. Even on the 4th of July, we don't usually have 20 minutes worth of fireworks.
Well, depending on where you go.
Well, like Seattle's only 10 minutes worth at the Space Needle.
No, they're 20 minutes.
Okay.
But it was kind of cool. I mean, on the Mersey, you know, the River Mersey that mm-hmm. goes through Liverpool, there were three
so ferry
yeah,
across
yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
Mersey.
That's what I meant. trying to drown it out, sorry. three different places on the Mersey. They had barges, and they set off fireworks at the same time. But the drum corps was really, really spectacular. They were setting off fireworks in between the buildings. Luckily, the buildings were all made of stone.
Stone.
Because they were hitting the buildings. Could you see that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I can't remember the name. I'll have something up on the Facebooks or Linkmaster General will put it up. It was part French and part Spanish percussion group that goes around and does this professionally. And we missed the very beginning, but they had some local drummers also at the end that they brought out and had them take a bow. And
they looked like they were in either Stormtrooper or Sith sort of costumes.
Yeah, yeah. They were very orange and black or white and black, and most of the white and black had like, I couldn't tell if it was skulls or just really good paint work over their faces.
I think they had masks on to protect them from the fireworks.
I would hazard a guess. And then they initially was a procession from like town hall down the street to this stage, and we had ducked into a bar. It was bitterly cold. And as anyone knows, I have no fear of cold. It was cold out there. So we ducked in. First, we got in line had some chips and watched an aerialist show, which is a plane show, two planes going back and forth with some smoke and then some, sparklers, pyrotechnics off the wings.
Yeah, and they were lit up. The planes were lit up right. With LED lights. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, on the exterior. So, and it was a pair of them doing some barrel rolls and loop-de-loops, and it was pretty entertaining. But we got the chips, and I didn't know what it was. I just saw it on the menu, and it said bacon roll, and I was like, okay, sure, what's not to like? It'll be a little Vienna sausage wrapped in bacon. No, it was a beautiful bun with, I don't know, 8 pieces of British bacon, which would be the equivalent of, I don't know, a pound of back bacon from the States.
It was quite a lot of bacon.
It was quite a lot, and nothing else. Just this glorious potato roll and bacon.
And that roll, like that, when you have it as a sandwich, it's called a butty.
A butty.
Butty.
Butty. Yes. B-U-T-T-Y.
A butty.
A butty. So it was a bacon butty. It was delicious, but we needed more inner core warmth, so we ducked into a bar, had an immensely long time trying to get served because everybody in town was packing every orifice of every building that was serving any sort of food or libation. The sea of humanity pouring out after the fireworks display was, it would have rivaled the Seahawks winning the Super Bowl celebration downtown. I mean, it was literally a sea of humanity.
It was a river of people.
It was.
And you had to go with the flow.
Yeah. There were a few times felt like spawning salmon going upstream.
That's exactly what it felt like.
So we missed the procession, but we got on to where the stage was, and we just kind of walked. And knowing patterns of people walking and everything, there was like this beautiful back eddy just to the side of one of their garbage bins. And so we were just walking with the crowd, and then I just grabbed Jennifer, and we just kind of backed in, and we were safe from the passing people. We were right in front of a bunch of people standing behind us on this barrier, so we had a really good shot of seeing this stuff, and it was just incredible, and the fireworks were pretty spectacular. And then we went
afterwards,
Sergeant Pepper's.
We went to that street where the Cavern Club
is. Cavern...
The Cavern Club.
Quarter. Cavern Quarter.
Oh, Cavern Quarter, right. So where the Beatles used to play. Mm-hmm. Liverpool.
Yes.
Liverpool. That's how they say it. Liverpool.
And so we went to, what was it, just Sergeant Pepper's? Is that the name of the first one?
Yeah, we went to Sergeant Pepper's. It was pretty good. They had a live band.
Yeah, that was pretty good, except they played... Give me three steps, yeah. Mister, about double time.
Oh, it was fine. And then they played Sweet Home Alabama, which was just kind of odd when you're in, you know, Liverpool.
Being sung by a British band. We went to Rubber Soul.
That was the other first one. We went to Legends, right? Didn't we?
Well,
that was beforehand.
That was beforehand.
Yeah, and then we went to a bar called Rubber Soul, yeah.
And spent a lot of time dancing there.
It was fun.
It was a lot of fun. And there were four of us, two other PAs, and Jen and myself. And we couldn't tell if it was a hen party, which is the bachelorette party, and the associated bachelors. Because oftentimes here they do them in conjunction. But there was just a swarm of men on the dance floor, just hanging out, cutting up, dancing, goofing on each other. And then all of a sudden they brought Kevin in, who was part of our group. And then they brought me in. And then we just had, like, all of a sudden we were a group of 40 people dancing for hours. It was a leg day at the gym for me on Friday, and the jumping and dancing and
the boys
frolicking.
Noticed.
They said my calves are legs. I'm like, yeah, that's not what they said. They liked my beard. Very impressed with the full beard.
So Scott got hit on, basically. Sorry.
They were just friendly dudes.
Right, that's what I always say too.
It's not that over here in England. Mates just go out drinking and carousing and, you know, playing grab ass. I don't know. Uh-huh. So I think we've talked enough about Guy Fawkes and his night, or my night. And then today, we had already on the docket to go to Liverpool. We swapped out the Hatton Guy Fawkes extravaganza for the Empire Theater Queen extravaganza.
Yes.
And boy, howdy, let me tell you.
It was awesome. It was really, really good.
Yeah. We were front row on the balcony, and I would take that any day over being on the floor, because you just had this clear view, not so high up that we've seen, like, Wicked and stuff. Not that those are bad seats for theater.
It wasn't nosebleed.
It was just enough off-center that you had a perspective of people. But you could see eyeballs and teeth, and, you know, it wasn't just this figure bopping around on stage. You could see very clearly everyone, and the talent on there, I mean, handpicked by Roger Taylor and Brian May. I don't know why Roger Deakin's not a part of this, but those guys handpicked everybody, and I've got pictures on my Facebook page, and I'm going to do some editing and stuff. We'll throw that on the Two Bards page. But just a phenomenal evening of Queen.
Yeah, they did an amazing job. All of the musicians were really spectacular, and they all sang beautifully. I mean, and they sounded so much. I don't think either of us have ever had the opportunity to see Queen, but this was definitely, it was amazing.
Yeah, I did see the first Brian May tour after Freddie passed, and they opened for Guns N' Roses, so it was a win-win in my opinion. And it was good. I mean, again, I had fairly okay seats. It was in a huge arena, so they weren't great, but seeing Brian May play classic Queen stuff and his own stuff, he's just an amazing guitarist. But yeah, this blew that away, hands down. And the bass player sang some of the songs. They had an independent keyboardist, so there were five members in the group. But they played everything, A Night of the Opera, full album, and then another, I don't know, 10, 12 songs after that. And they kept pretty close to the album side of things.
Yeah.
So it was everything that you remembered, but the drummer could hit all the notes that Roger Taylor can hit. I mean, a drummer that's that good and has that high a falsetto, and, you know, I'm in love with my car being sung live, and the bass player was spot on for in the second set, was spot on for David Bowie in Under Pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing it was hairs on the back of my neck were standing on end, and I had tears in my eyes. It was beautiful.
It was good very stuff. Nice, yes. But, yeah, okay. You have tears in your eyes a lot of times.
but and our listeners know that.
And this was beautiful, it was.
Should we throw it over to Andy and Todd at this point?
I think probably.
Anything more to say?
No, just thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
Since I'm here.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Now you don't have to listen to me talk to myself in the other room. It's great. All right, so here's Andy and Todd. We'll talk to you later.
Hey, hey, Bardketeers. So we are here with a special interview with Todd Downing, the writer of Airship Daedalus. Hey, Todd.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, doing very well. You might also know Todd from some of his film production, things like The Collectibles,
mm-hmm.
The Two Bards Collaborated Lunch mm-hmm. that we provided cinematography for, as well as some editing.
Yes.
What else would we know you from, Todd?
Some Zoe stuff. Most recently, I was the production designer on Journey Quest Season 3.
Yeah, Scott and I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, and some graphic design for props on the Gamers series.
Ah, which is filming right now, actually.
Exactly.
So we are awesome. That is great. Mm-hmm. That is great. But that is not what we are here to talk about today.
No.
No. What we are here to talk about, listeners, is have you accepted... No. Sorry, that's a... what we're here to talk about today is Airship Daedalus.
Yes.
Scott and I did get to do a little bit of work on the very first audio play.
Right.
Which was a radio play on CD, essentially.
Right.
Done in that old style. We loved it. We had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's happening in the Daedalus world?
Well, let's see. Boy, there's a lot going on right now. Just this year, I think in February or March, let me just consult my notes. We put out the Airship Daedalus role-playing game, which is kind of opening up the whole setting to a role-playing type activity, which is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And right on the heels of that, we also put out a supplement for that, the Aegis Field Manual. So that's, you know, additional crunchy bits and that kind of thing. And then I contacted an author that I've worked with on some game stuff in the past. He wrote some of the official Red Dwarf RPG that we produced over a decade ago. And mm-hmm. and he is starting to make a name for himself. Actually, he's starting to make names plural for himself, because he actually writes under two different pseudonyms. One, he's developing this contemporary espionage property, which Ooh. Is, yeah, it's kind of a Bourne, action of Bourne meets the panache of Bond. And that's under one name. And then he goes by E.J. Blaine for some of his more pulpy science fiction-y stuff. And he has authored the first licensed Airship Daedalus novel.
As E.J. Blaine.
As E.J. Blaine.
That is such a great sci-fi writer name.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, that's solid. That's solid.
Well, I was asking him why he chose, you know, the various pseudonyms, and he said, you know, there are so many John Sullivans writing right now that he wouldn't be able to get any traction under using his own name, so.
Right.
So that's what he's doing. And it's Excellent. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. It's weird. It's a little bit weird as the author of a property, as somebody who's done all the primary development of the characters and the setting and everything, to have somebody else just kind of take those things and run with it. But mm-hmm. but if he did not run with it and get a touchdown, I don't know how else to describe it. It was just, it is so gratifying to see him treat the characters properly, and you know, everything was as I would have written it if I had.
Right. So when can we get a copy of this?
Well, it goes, let's see.
And where, I suppose, would be another good question.
Yes. Well, it's going to be an ebook and print.
Okay.
So, both of those, formats. And when I say ebook, I mean like EPUB and Amazon, and
right,
Mobi
right.
and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so, and I'm looking for my talking points, which I have lost in the shuffle of getting this together.
Well, I know for a fact that pre-orders start on November 7th.
Yes.
And you can have it in your hands on the 18th.
Yes, that is correct.
November.
That is correct.
Yeah.
I now have it open.
And it, cool. Is there a way of buying it that gets more money back to you, the artists?
Well,
or is it all kind of like a wash?
Yeah, so we're kind of new. It's really weird. So when I started Deep Seven, now Deep Seven Press, back in 1999, with two mm-hmm. other partners, and now I'm kind of running it solo as kind of a cottage, little, you know, out of my office kind of thing. But you know, we were among the first you know, game publishers to offer content in digital format, primarily in PDF, back before that was really legitimized as a format that people were buying in. And mm-hmm. so now I find it very ironic that, you know, 17 years later, I'm now starting to experiment with like the established formats of e-publishing, mm-hmm. in terms of like the readers and things like that, which, you know, have very, very different parameters.
Right.
Yeah. So this is only our second ebook. The first one being a nonfiction biography that we put out a couple of years ago. But
oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, just go out and find it on your favorite shop. Then.
Yeah, we will be Amazon exclusive for the first.
Oh,
I think 90 days.
Right. Yeah, they do that.
Yeah.
They do that. But you probably get a better deal because
exactly,
of it, right?
Exactly. And it allows us to do some promotions and things like that. But that does not exclude, I mean, it does exclude the print version, which will be available not only on Amazon Print On Demand, but also on drivethroughfiction.com.
And is that related, I'm assuming, to DriveThruRPG, which a lot, I mean, I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with DriveThruRPG, so.
Absolutely. In fact, it's all under one roof. It's the one bookshelf company that runs all these, you know, various things. And in fact, that's where they can actually download the original Airship Daedalus radio dramas on DriveThruFiction as well.
There you go. Like, go out and get your Daedalus on right now. So how does this fit in kind of with the existing Daedalus and maybe with what, if there's anything else coming up? How does the novel fit in sort of with this world you've already created?
Right. Okay. So the world, for people who don't know what the Airship Daedalus setting and the Aegis Tales setting is about, it's primarily a pulp adventure setting, which mm-hmm. it's based on a popular style of you know, novels and comics and radio dramas that were produced between the 20s and the 40s, basically the interwar period. And it's where like modern superhero mythology comes from and that kind of thing. And so we're couched in that retro 1920s mm-hmm. to 40s, you know, post-World War I, like our main heroes served in the war together and they had adventures together. It's also a world in which, you know, magic and the occult and, you know, interdimensional monsters and eldritch terrors and things like that, and lost mm-hmm. worlds, you know, pockets where, you know, dinosaurs still live on and you know, the hollow earth and hollow moon for that matter. And there's life on Mars and Venus and things like that. So all that stuff actually exists in the context of this setting.
Right. So essentially all of the, I wouldn't say tropey, but all of those sort of fanciful flights of fancy that were extremely popular during that time.
Absolutely.
You've essentially made real,
right,
in this world. And okay, excellent.
Exactly. And then on top of that, we've kind of diverged the our real history into an alternate timeline where, starting early on in the history of the United States, a few things were different. One was that this being pulp, you know, the good guys are very good and the bad guys are very bad. And so all of the historical characters that have, you know, some positive elements to them, we paint them in their most benevolent, most benign possible version. And likewise with the villains. Our main big bad in this part of the timeline is Aleister Crowley. A lot of people know who he is, and he was kind of, you know, this very sensationalist, vagabond man of the world. He was a mountaineer, and he was a mage, really. He was an arcanist. He studied all kinds of magic, Egyptian and ancient Hebrew magics and things like that. And
so are you, I'm assuming there's going to be a little bit of sanitization, because Aleister Crowley had some other, he had some sort of Rasputin-esque magic that he did.
Yes.
I don't recall any of that being.
He wasn't down with the women in terms of treating them equally. He used to, you know, when he wanted women to be brought to his rituals, he said they ought to be brought round the back, but like the milk, that kind of thing. And so we're going to be sanitizing that somewhat. We still have to make him evil, like it's the fruits of the devil. But
evil.
Yes.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
You know, he's still trying to conquer the world by opening rifts into other dimensions and bringing through demonic hordes to serve his will, you know, and that kind of thing. And really serving as almost a proto-Nazi influence in the setting.
That's a very comic booky feel to it.
Yeah, well, so, you know, you've got Germany in the aftermath of World War I, which is very depressed, and it, you know, the German people got screwed by the convention that, you know, by the treaty of Versailles afterwards, and it kind of set up the whole, you know, the environment for the rise of fascism. So what we're doing is kind of, we're taking those disaffected Germans who don't have jobs and whatnot, and we're having them follow Crowley, as well as, you know, people from all over the world, really. All kinds of disaffected people are flocking to his banner because he's promising them power and autonomy and, you know, some kind of say in their lives. So
Right. Which is, I mean, that's a pretty common way to sort of get people behind you.
Exactly.
Very relevant right now, frankly.
I think that, you know, kind of I'm not saying reinventing pulp, but kind of adapting the pulp formula to our own purposes to make pulp a little bit more accessible, more representative, and while still retaining the heroic flavor and the fun and the action, stuff like that. Because, you know, quite honestly, classic pulp is often filled with casual racism and misogyny.
Yes.
And that's not what we're embracing about it. We're embracing the fun and the adventure and the horror and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's really emerging.
The farce.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, were you a fan of pulp growing up? Were you a reader of pulp or pulp comics or any of that type of thing?
Well, of course, I grew up reading comic books. I mean, that was that was just kind of de rigueur. That was what I spent all my allowance on, and had all the Mego superhero action figures and stuff like that. You know, it was the mid-70s. and so, but once I got older, I started getting more into like the actual classic pulp, like The Shadow.
Oh, right. The Shadow knows.
Yep.
The Shadow's got a vague idea.
He's got a vague idea.
All right.
what evil lurks in the hearts of men.
What danger. Oh, yeah, what danger. Yeah. Evil lurks in the hearts. Yes. And, of course, you know, Billy Zane.
Oh, dude. The best. The Phantom. I had...
Oh, that was the Phantom, right.
Yeah, that was...
I love... Alec Baldwin played the Shadow,
Baldwin,
didn't he?
Yes.
Oh, my God. I forgot about that with the nose and the red scarf.
Yeah. I remember at the time, I was not down with that at all. I really...
I can see still not being down with that at all.
You know, but I just got the Blu-ray and I rewatched it, mm-hmm. and it's not at all the movie that I remember hating in the 90s when it came out. It's not at all that. So, and I had the same reaction, honestly, to the Phantom with Billy Zane. I love it now, mm-hmm. but I did not like it at the time, and I don't know why.
Yeah, I think for me, I know exactly why I wasn't into those at the time. Mm-hmm. Because there was like kind of the, I don't know, I feel like Darkman was almost a deconstruction of some of that in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And you know, Darkman was like, that was a sort of hit for film people. Like people who liked movies liked that movie.
For sure.
And I think it was that 90s like feeling of the only way to properly talk about something is to critique it, right. and to strongly critique it. And we can't enjoy those things because they're from an old time when people were stupid, you know? And I think that there's like this feeling of the desire to go back to the simpler story structure and the simpler, you know, like you were saying earlier, absolute good versus absolute evil.
Right.
We wanted nuance in the 90s.
Sure.
In the 90s, we'd lost our villains.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's true. The heroes, you know, became the villains.
Right, right. And even politically, globally, we'd lost our villains. We have never really had that sort of security since.
Right.
And we hadn't had it for, you know, probably 40 years at that point.
Sure.
So I feel like we were so cynical.
Yeah.
That, you know, we the only thing that we had anymore to fear was humanity and was our own sort of like our past. And, mm-hmm. and we were also sort of full bore at that point into sort of the overcorrecting of racism, mm-hmm. where instead of acknowledging it and fixing it, we just steered straight on into it doesn't exist. So let's just bury our heads.
Exactly.
And I think that the Phantom, particularly, and the Shadow, I don't know very well at all, but I think the Phantom particularly was sort of a return to that camp. You know,
yeah.
it was much more, hey, we loved these stories, so this is one of those. This isn't a retelling. This isn't a gritty. This is just one of those stories, which is weird because The Rocketeer did that as well, but was met with much more positive feedback. So
yeah, and I don't know necessarily why. I know I forget who directed. I know Joe Johnston directed The Rocketeer. I don't know who did The Phantom. Russell Mulcahy did The Shadow.
Really? Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, but originally Sam Raimi was reported to be attached to it, and something happened while it was in development hell, and he had to walk away and decided to do his own version, which ended up being Darkman. And
oh, right, of course.
And, and I always thought that Liam Neeson had the nose for Lamont Cranston, mm-hmm. you know, to really, you know, to be that character. So
I totally agree. So Simon Windsor did The Phantom.
Okay.
So
yeah, no, it's what's not to love, man. A guy in a purple suit in a jungle hideout with a horse and a wolf and, you know, female sky pirates. It's great.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's definitely one of those. I've got a list of movies that I want to re-examine mm-hmm. with less cynicism than I had when I was, I mean, I was in high school. Like, I graduated in 1995. Mm-hmm. So that point of time, generally when you graduate, it's like a 50-50 thing. For some people, when you graduate, everything that happens then is the best it can ever be.
Uh-huh.
And for some people, when you graduate, the world is a terrible place and you're smarter than everyone. And so you can't enjoy anything that happens during that time.
Exactly.
And I was in that second, you know, I was in the second category.
Oh, no.
I was in the, the loner lunchroom category.
Oh.
So I have a lot of movies from that era that if they weren't cynical and if they weren't angry and if they weren't dark,
mm-hmm.
you know, I wasn't really into them.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's kind of funny because I go back now and I watch, and I might piss some listeners off for this, but I don't care. I go back and I watch like Clerks now,
mm-hmm.
and it is juvenile.
Yeah.
It is an extremely juvenile movie, and not juvenile. I don't just mean the you know, the dick and fart jokes,
because
it's fine. You can do those. I mean, we've seen. I think Rick and Morty is a good example of a non-juvenile way to do, you know, and it's a cartoon, mm-hmm. of course, but it's a non-juvenile way to do a lot of these kind of crazy jokes. Kevin Smith had created a movie that when I was 18
mm-hmm.
in 1995 and I was angry at everything, mirrored about my sensibility and my ability to crack wise and mirrored my angst toward the general population.
Absolutely.
So
it was a movie about misanthropes for misanthropes.
Exactly. Watching Clerks now is actually kind of painful.
It kind of is.
For two reasons. One, it's a mirror at how bad my taste was back then. I'm not saying necessarily
that can be forgiven, though. It was, you know, it's a good movie for a time and a place, and it's a time capsule, as most movies are.
Very much so, very much so. But the second reason that I think that it kind of hurts me inside, where I, you know, where I keep my soul, is that it's also kind of the high water mark for Kevin Smith. Like, he hasn't really grown in any way. That's not fair. His films haven't grown.
Mm.
I think that Kevin Smith himself, like, if you look at, you know, Comic Book Men, or if you just listen to his podcasts in general, the Smodcast or Fat Man on Batman or any of those, he himself has grown in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of the stuff he's done that isn't film or aren't his films specifically, mm-hmm. have shown a little bit of growth. But like Clerks 2 is a good example, mm-hmm. of like it not only did it not grow to sort of meet the new zeitgeist,
mm-hmm.
Sort of, you know, because like you said, the Clerks was a movie of its time. Clerks 2 was not a movie of its time.
No.
It wasn't a movie of any time. Clerks 2 was just, let's just throw a bunch of words that sound vaguely Clerk-like, mm-hmm. at the screen and see what happens. So for me, that's kind of what watching Clerks is like. It's kind of sad, but
on the upside, it does have the classic line: "You never go ass to mouth."
You never go ass to mouth. On the same token, though, like, there are a lot of these movies that I just despised, because I thought they were childish or stupid or whatever, you know, or they were too happy. They were far, far too optimistic for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to go revisit just a shitload of movies, man. Unfortunately, you know, like, who has time for that?
Well, exactly. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I have no problem with dark and gritty as long as it's not the mm-hmm. sum total of what you're trying to tell in your story. You know, all too
we could
often
have a whole podcast.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I think we were, maybe chatting online, on Facebook or something about, mm-hmm. you know, stuff going on in media right now, especially, I look at, The Walking Dead, where mm-hmm. in the last episode I had to step off finally. 'Cause it's like, you know, I can't handle bleakness for bleakness sake. You know, if there's no kernel of, hey, we're working towards something better and there's something better out there, why am I mm-hmm. spending my time watching this story? Because you're just you're telling a story of somebody walking around in circles.
Right, right.
And so,
I think if there's... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, just to, you know, to bring it back to the whole pulp thing, is that that's what we're trying to retain, is that kernel of... And it might be us looking back... you know, with nostalgia on a quote unquote simpler time. I don't think it was a simpler time. I think people had very different tastes and, you know, actually wanted a through line of hope.
Yeah, I think that's a. I think that's absolutely fair. My whole thing, again, we could have a full podcast mm-hmm. on nostalgia, on retro.
Oh, for sure.
On sort of the, my big issue with nostalgia is, it's not even being sold correctly. Nostalgia is supposed to hurt.
Yeah.
Nostalgia is a wistful longing. It's an emptiness for days gone by.
Exactly.
You know, this is more like just repackaging the best parts that you remember mm-hmm. and selling it back to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is where a lot of the sort of, I think animosity toward remakes is coming from, is uh-huh. this fact that it's been marketized, and the marketization has been weaponized. I mean, it is formulaic.
Oh
now.
Yeah.
Pick thing A from time period mm-hmm. B, sell to group C, and you know, profit.
Exactly.
So, and I have definite feelings on a lot of the stuff that's come out lately, and not all of them are negative.
Sure.
I'm one of the few people who I don't have negative things to say about the new Ghostbusters film mm-hmm. because it is not a remake in any way.
Right.
It is the brand moving to a completely new property.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you could talk about the money aspect of it because it's Sony
mm-hmm.
and let's not kid ourselves. Sony, they're not in it to preserve art.
Nope.
They're not even in it to make art.
Nope.
They're in it to make literal dollar bills
yep.
come into their pockets. Which
only
is
because
very
it's illegal
apparent.
To print them themselves.
Yeah. Well, for now, we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah.
but yeah, I think that, that there's a difference between, doing an homage that actually captures, and this is going to circle back kind of to what you're doing mm-hmm. with Daedalus, because what you're doing is a full on homage.
Mm-hmm.
It is, while you are, you know, tweaking things a little bit to get rid of some of the bad,
the problematic
construct, you're not just presenting all of the, you know, you're presenting it warts and all. You're presenting, the sort of the downbeats of the era too. Like this isn't just you know, someone going out with a six shooter and a girl on his hip, you know, buckling swash.
Mm-hmm.
There's drama, there's the, you know, danger, there's all of the things that the ups and the downs of the sort of pulp the whole pulp genre.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what you've done with it so far is great, because you've translated, like, again, you've dumped the stuff that is just toxic,
mm-hmm.
but you've translated the rest to make it accessible and you know, understandable. And I think that's really great.
Well, thank you.
It doesn't have to be.
That's where I was going with when I was originally saying when the timeline diverged. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to say with that is that a couple of aspects that are different is that in the Airship Daedalus setting, the United States actually honored their treaties with the indigenous people. So there was no Trail
so it
of
is a
Tears.
Fantasy.
Yes, it's a complete yeah, fantasy. Okay. So there was no Trail of Tears. That it made for easier assimilation of native peoples mm-hmm. into the general populace, because there was
right.
no forced conversion and that kind of stuff. And the second thing, it's a major thing, is that post-Civil War South, the insurgencies were put down militarily, and Reconstruction was seen through. So mm-hmm. there didn't end up being Jim Crow legacy in the South. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, D.W. Griffith never made Birth of a Nation, and the KKK didn't reorganize. So
right.
while there is personal bias and personal racism everywhere in the world, mm-hmm. it is not systemic like it exists in our own history, in our own
right.
timeline.
Right.
So that is one way that, you know, we can kind of open it up and have really great pulp characters that can be iconic, but that can be of color, that can be a different gender, mm-hmm. that can be a different orientation.
See, that's great. That's because it doesn't feel like tokenism when you do it that way.
Exactly. There are legitimate reasons for why things are the way they are.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important because I love the push for more diversity, you know, in everything. Mm-hmm. I think it's great, but if you're not careful, you produce tokenism, and tokenism is extremely, extremely regressive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome. That's a great way to do it. So for fans of the existing Airship Daedalus,
right? Oh, you were asking where the novel comes in.
Right. Where? Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Where does it come in?
So if people have listened to the original four episodes of the Airship Daedalus radio adventures or have read the first three chapters of the comic, and chapter four is actually in the works. Brian Beardsley is finishing the art for that. It's been
excellent.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, but he had an interstate move and some college to finish. So, but it happens. So that stuff in the original story happens in 1925.
Okay.
And there's some stuff that happens in the interim that I will go back and kind of dramatize, and maybe it might be another, you know, one-shot comic kind of thing. But it's not of huge import to the overall timeline. And then the novel takes place. The novel's called Assassins of the Lost Kingdom. And it takes place in July of 1926. And then the new... Oh, we haven't gotten to this yet. The new four-part Airship Daedalus radio story.
Right. We haven't. I'm really excited to talk about this.
Okay.
Where
do you want to start on that?
Well, let's start with, I think leading into kind of how the book plugs into the new four-part.
Right.
Because the book is like you were saying, the book is the next thing you can have in your hands.
Right.
So that is a great lead up to what we hope is the, what you've already, is this all ready recorded?
Yeah, it's all done. It's
wonderful.
All done. Yeah, it's just being packaged right now. I've got the first CD proofs on their way, and we're just kind of plotting it out so that we can, you know, kind of hype the book a little bit, hype the novel, and then just before Christmas, do another push for the radio shows.
Excellent.
So this is a four-part story that takes place in. So after the first four episodes of the Airship Daedalus radio adventures, the production company that I was a part of, Moon Bullet Studios, went away. It's no longer a thing. So all of the stuff that was like, you know, my intellectual property from Moon Bullet, I retained and brought over under Despot Media and Deep Seven Press, which are that's my production entity.
Right.
And I started doing, I did Aegis Tales radio adventures, and I did four episodes of that, and those are one-shot stories. Each episode is one separate story with different characters, and it's more of an expansion of the Airship Daedalus universe, but it's more kind of street-level crime, horror, vigilantes, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I always wanted to maintain the Airship Daedalus because that's more of an international high-flying adventure kind of flair, and that's very much part, that's the backbone of the setting. And so I wrote this four-part story called The Golden City and was lucky enough to get the whole original cast back, except for Connor Marks, who had a scheduling conflict. And
Connor.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
Oh, I'm still gonna get Connor gets ribbed. He knows he knows it. He knows why. Connor.
You know what you did.
So if you don't, make something up.
So Deadeye in this case is played by Sean Shelton.
Who is an amazing voice actor,
he
by the
is.
Way. For those, like surprisingly it's funny because, you know, a lot of people listening know of Sean Shelton, mm-hmm. but they know of him as the makeup guy that does all the DG Journey Quest makeup. Mm-hmm. And he's working on, like, Chaldea, and he's doing, you know, he did makeup for 21 and Over and all these amazing, like, products. And he was the mayor in And That's the Mayor.
Right.
But the guy has a voice, like a vocal range that is incredible.
Yes.
He can do a perfect anything Billy West can do, for example.
Pretty much.
Plus some other stuff.
Yeah, so he had already played Oscar Morgan, who is a mage, mm-hmm. in the greater setting, as a mm-hmm. guest role in one of the Aegis Tales episodes. And then I asked him to come back and understudy for Connor, just in case we couldn't get his recordings in time.
Right, right.
And so he understudied the role and ended up, he fit in just perfectly with all the rest of the voices. And so we ended up keeping it. He also does an English spy master. And I think that's all he does in this new one. We also have Wanda Russell in a featured guest role. In addition to, like I was saying, the whole rest of the original crew is back. Angela DeMarco and Matt Shimkus and...
Wonderful.
Yes. Luke Amundsen, David S. Hogan, and Carly Hill is actually not only reprising Maria Blutig, the villain, but she's also mm-hmm. playing the new East Indian radio woman on the Daedalus, Marissa Singh, who is known as Cypher. Cool.
Now, did you have to like fly her up, or did she record? Because she's now in LA, isn't she?
She's in the Bay Area.
Bay Area.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she's a brand new mother and still working in advertising, but doing some voiceover mm-hmm. stuff. And so we have worked remotely on the first few episodes of Aegis Tales. And then I asked her to come back and do this, and she just happened to be visiting.
Oh, perfect.
At the time, so I was able to get her in my studio.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, and I was able to get Angela and Matt to do all of their scenes together, which formed...
Oh, nice.
That formed the backbone. Then everybody else could do their lines one-off, and I could just edit them together. Like Scott, who's in England, did Rivets, mm-hmm. all of his Rivets material, and send them to me.
Rivets. You gotta love Rivets.
And that's become a new thing, by the way, because Matt and Angela, when they were ad-libbing a laugh at the end of one of the first scenes they did together, and Matt said, mm-hmm. oh, Rivets. So that's now a thing. When you laugh,
I love
you just finish it with, Rivets.
Oh, Rivets.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll make that a thing here, too.
And you know what? I can give you access to the files if you want to do... This is as an aside, Scott. You might mm-hmm. want to cut this part out. But
oh, we'll leave it in.
Oh, okay. If you wanted to do, do like a scene or something to add a scene into the show from the radio show, you might...
So that's actually a great idea. And I think that
when we're closer to release...
Well, like for the show that precedes the street date of the book, mm-hmm. maybe, or maybe closer to the December 9th release of the Radio Adventures. I think that would be amazing. So yeah,
that
let's definitely
fun.
Do that.
Okay, I'll give you access to the files anyway, just so you can hear them, because cool. I think you'd enjoy them.
Yes, for sure. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on and giving us a talk. And if you don't mind, I'm gonna read the back cover text from the book.
Yeah.
For everybody, because I want to. This is very much a true homage. So you'll see, even in the writing of the back cover, it is like an absolute homage to this time. And I think it's wonderful that you've done it. I think it's wonderful that. It's super awesome because I actually didn't know that this was all coming out. So now I've got this awesome set of stuff to catch up on and enjoy into the next year. So thank you.
Oh, sweet. Thank you very much.
No problem. All right. So, for those of you playing at home, July 1926 finds ace pilot Jack McGraw and scientist Dorothy Doc Star hot on the trail of evil agents murdering prominent captains of industry. A trail that leads them to face an old enemy they thought vanquished. With the backing of Thomas Edison's Aegis Foundation, Jack and the Doc fly their light reconnaissance airship Daedalus to the Himalayas, where a deeper mystery unfolds. Together with their crewmates, they delve into local customs and ancient lore surrounding the Eye of the World, a hidden kingdom in the heart of the mountains known as Shambhala, where the only antidote to the world's deadliest poison still grows wild. Based on the Airship Daedalus comic strip by Todd Downing and Brian Beardsley, Assassins of the Last Kingdom is the first novel from author E.J. Blaine. That's a pseudonym. We covered that. Who brings the fun and excitement of classic adventure stories to the fore. Mobsters, mad scientists, secret societies, occult threats, and lost worlds meet globe-trotting, sky-high aerial action and two-fisted heroism like the pulp novels of old. So that's Airship Daedalus. Everyone, please go check it out. And a big thank you again to Todd Downing for showing up. We hope you like it. And tune in to future episodes of Two Bards, One Mic for a sneak listen to Airship Daedalus, the new radio adventures, The Golden City.
All right. And that was Andy and Todd with their interview that I'll listen to later. Anyway, just thank you very much for listening, everyone. And as always, Neil deGrasse Tyson, if you're listening, if you're within the sound of our collective voices, we implore you to come on to the podcast.
Come on, Neil. You can do it. Come on. It's about time.
Oh, I see what you did there. That's great. Okay, so I don't want to lose my job to Jen. So for all of our Patreon subscribers, it's a new month. We have a new list. So thank you to Hawk Robinson,
Leslie Sedlick,
Jay Blanken,
Rob McLennan,
Zombie Orpheus Entertainment,
James Peters,
Gordon D. Duke,
Digby Davis, LLC,
Donald Evans,
Dougie Sharp,
Todd McKimmy,
Amanda Cook,
Lotta Jerf,
Tom Brophy,
Laura Adams,
James Herbert,
Adam Morey,
Tim Martin,
Paula Moran,
Matt Vansel,
Brad Roberts,
Jennifer Reifenberry, that's me.
That's you. And Rival Guy. Till next time, thanks, folks. Say goodnight, Gracie.
Good night, Scott.